This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com. This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Caleb Maupin. He's a journalist, and he has a new book out, Kamala Harris and the Future of America. Caleb, it's great having you on.
Sure. Glad to be here.
Can you start off by giving us some background information about you? So you've been a journalist now with Russia Today, and also can you talk about your involvement in Occupy Wall Street and also the anti-war movements during the Obama era?
Sure, yeah. I mean, I've been involved in many struggles for social justice. I marched against the drones. I marched against the U.S. intervention in Libya. I think the first war I protested against was the invasion of Iraq by George W. Bush. I have been involved in many such things. I view things from more or less a Marxist or socialist perspective. I think that Western capitalism and imperialism is driving humanity in a dangerous direction. That millions are kept in poverty so that Wall Street and London can stay rich. I think that there are many countries around the world that have broken out of that system and started to develop independently, and that's a good step forward. And we need a new model in global trade based on win-win cooperation, where countries benefit from trading with each other. I really like the Belt and Road Initiative that China has started. I like the Eurasian Economic Union that Russia is at the center of. I'm excited about Bolivarian socialism in Latin America. And I think that we in the United States, we have a long tradition of progressive struggles, whether it's the struggle to abolish slavery, the struggle for women's rights, you know, and that progressive-minded people who want to get beyond capitalism, have a special place in U.S. history. And that as much as the right wing would like to tell us that capitalism is part of what it means to be an American, there have always been progressive people in this country, and that eventually I do believe that working people in this country will take control and we will get beyond the capitalist system here in America, and I'm optimistic about that.
As far as your new book out about Kamala Harris, there's a very good chance she could likely be our next president. I guess the big controversy was her record as a prosecutor during the tough on crime era and what was brought up in the debate with Tulsi Gabbard, but can you give us just an introduction to the book, and are you criticizing her primarily from a progressive standpoint?
I would say so, yeah. I mean, but the book is not simply like a hit piece on Kamala Harris, okay? It's not like the case against Kamala Harris. The book is an essay in three parts about the United States and where things are going. And I see, I see Kamala Harris as the culmination of a number of trends that have developed over the course of the last several decades in the United States. I feel that left-wing politics has largely been distorted. I feel like the United States is moving in a polarized direction. We are facing a crisis as a society, and that, you know, Kamala Harris is very much the product of our time, and figures like her kind of represent how weird politics has become distorted. And that's kind of the focus of the book. I try to give my readers an understanding of how Kamala Harris fits in with the direction all of U.S. society is going. I'm very critical of Trump in the book. I am not a Trump supporter by any means. But I think that there are things about the Joe Biden-Kamala Harris camp that should be very, very worrying to any progressive-minded person, and that we're dealing with a big fight among our ruling class. There are two factions that are battling for power right now among the rich and powerful in the United States.
To what degree do you go into her record on criminal justice? Is the stuff you cover, is there unique information, or most of it is the same information that was, say, discussed in the debate with Tulsi?
It's pretty much the same. I mean, Tulsi didn't talk about the video where she laughs about how she jailed the parents of children who were truant from school. I talk about that. I dig into her father and Donald Harris and, you know, some of the baggage there, you know, and you know, show that in her autobiography, she's not exactly honest. She says the only thing her parents thought about was the books. But if you read Donald Harris's essay, Reflections of a Jamaican Father, it's pretty clear there was a custody battle. Kamala Harris's father is a, you know, a Marxian social democratic economist who not only taught at Stanford University, but was an advisor to a number of prime ministers of Jamaica. And he has denounced her campaign. She's pretty much estranged from him. I get into some of that history. There's a lot of things I talk about, but the main thing is the book is not meant to, like, take her down or something like that, right? She is a product of her time, and that what it means to be a leftist and what it means to be a progressive has been subject to a huge amount of distortion in the United States, and the psychology that motivates people to become left-wing has also been widely distorted and confused, and that's really what the book is about. It's about the future of America and the role of progressive politics, and you know, Kamala Harris is appealing to a crowd of people. You know, you talk about the woke crowd, the people that are involved in a lot of the identity politics on the internet these days. It's about unleashing people's rage, unleashing people's anger and injustice, and people's destructive impulses. And that has become what left-wing politics has been focused on. It has been about helping people to unleash their pent-up feelings of rage and their desire to tear things down. When in reality, socialism historically has been about construction. It has been about, you know, the desire to get beyond a society ruled by profits, people coming together to build a whole new world. And I talk about Abraham Lincoln and his progressive side. I talk about Huey Long, the governor of Louisiana, who remains very popular in Louisiana even today. Huey Newton of the Black Panthers is actually named after Huey Long. I talk also about Roosevelt and his alliance with the Communist Party during the Popular Front period, and their efforts to roll back fascism. You know, progressivism throughout U.S. history looks very different than what is calling itself progressivism now. And I think that the reason Donald Trump has a good chance of winning this upcoming election is because a lot of Americans, they see the left simply as a destructive mob of people that want to tear things down. America was never great. The country is racist and evil, and average Americans are evil, and we just want to tear things apart, destroy the country, and that's not an appealing message.
There's no vision for the future. They want to tear down ideas of what America is, but they have no positive vision for the future.
Well, they should. I mean, Bernie Sanders certainly did, and there is a strand that certainly does have a progressive vision, but when they tore down Confederate statues, which was absolutely the right thing to do, they didn't replace them with anything. And that there's widely an idea in left-wing circles that having statues at all is somehow wrong, that there is no truth, that everything is a matter of opinion and competing narratives, and that if you fight for a cause, if you believe in something strongly enough, that if you do that, that you are a sucker, and that the world is simply getting worse and worse. The planet is heating up because of global warming. We're all going to die. And the problem is progress. We've gone too far. It's almost like the biblical story of the Tower of Babel, and human beings are breeding too much. And there's this really pessimistic, dark, destructive narrative that has kind of gripped left-wing circles. And the history of socialism in the United States is very contrary to that. Marxism is a progressive ideology that believes in humanity and the ability of human beings to get to a higher state of being and a higher mode of production. And I feel like there has been a big effort to kind of erode that, and that largely that has become the problem in left-wing circles, and that Kamala Harris and the worldview she espouses, and some of the ways in her campaign, she talks a lot about her own childhood. For example, there's, you know, throughout her life, you can see a real desire to destroy, a real kind of vindictive.
To what degree do you get into, like, her psychological profile and her overall moral framework?
No, quite a bit, because I think that she is quite problematic, no doubt about it.
Can you give some specific examples of psychological traits?
Well, for example, when you talk about the fact that as the prosecutor of California, again, none of this is my own research. I'm just drawing from other people's work. You know, when she was the district attorney for Oakland, when she was, you know, the California DA prosecutor, I mean, there was a record of trying to keep innocent people on death row, trying to suppress DNA evidence, trying to fight against exonerations. There was a record of another example would be, when it came to the marijuana laws, the fact that she joked herself about smoking marijuana, right? The fact that she smoked marijuana when it's actually much higher than Tulsi Gabbard. Tulsi Gabbard said 1,500 people. It's actually 1,900 people who she gave criminal records for, gave criminal records for smoking marijuana, and jokes about it herself and laughs it off, the fact that she smoked it herself. I mean, that's pretty problematic, and that's pretty concerning. And the record of the California district attorney, that is quite concerning. Parents have looked into it. Many people concerned about basic civil liberties have talked about prosecutorial misconduct in California under her leadership. It's quite disturbing stuff. Look into the details.
Yeah, I know there was the case with this man on death row and involving DNA evidence.
Kevin Cooper, yes.
All right.
And any moral person would want to make sure that they were executing the right person. Put the debate about the death penalty aside, right? Would you want on your conscience for the rest of your life that you killed an innocent person, and if you had just allowed DNA evidence, you might have not done so? But it seemed like there's no concern about that. There's this desire to punish, this desire to destroy that is very, very destructive. This is the curse of the era. It's not just Kamala. It was the whole U.S. political system where the tough-on-crime laws were being used to build careers. This appeal to vengeance was very widespread. But it's very, very dangerous. And I get into that, and I talk about her personality and how her personality seems to have developed, and I get into it, and I encourage people to read it. Again, I'm not trying to make the case that Trump is necessarily better. Trump really disturbs me. And towards the end of the book, I get into, some of the problems with Trump, in particular, some of the narratives he uses about immigrants and such to build up his campaign, and some of the very, very dark ties of it. The country is moving in a very, very dangerous direction. I think Kamala Harris's career is an illustration of that, and that's why I put the book out.
To what degree does identity politics play a role to her personally and also reflect a greater overall trend on politics?
Well, it's interesting. If you watched Kamala Harris's speech at the Democratic National Convention, in the video that preceded it, they brought up the fact that she was a woman of color many, many times. And I know many people of color who voted for Barack Obama simply because they wanted their child to grow up knowing that it was possible for them as a person of color to be president. And that's respectable. They're not wrong. It's a very strong argument about why Barack Obama's presidency was so meaningful. And identity politics, you can't just completely dismiss it, right? And we have to recognize the struggles that women have been through, the struggles that people of color have been through, and how symbolic victories can be very, very meaningful. But beyond that, policy matters. Who the person of color is who's leading matters. And that if you just see Kamala simply as a woman of color becoming the first vice president and potentially the next president, if that's all you see her as, you're not really thinking about the country overall, because there are some very, very dangerous trends in the United States right now. There's the danger, I think, of a new world war on the horizon. We're facing economic decay. Donald Trump has completely mismanaged the pandemic. Our country is facing a crisis right now, and the leadership that we have in the coming years could be very, very vital. And big decisions are being made now that could have really lasting implications.
As far as VP picks and the Democratic primary, was Kamala the favorite of the donor class, including Big Tech and Wall Street?
Well, what's interesting was I quote in the book, a number of articles revealed that many of the financial backers of Hillary Clinton picked Kamala Harris, that she had some meetings in the Hamptons in Long Island, New York, where some of the wealthiest people, Silicon Valley and others, gathered and decided to put their money behind Kamala Harris. And that decision was made. And Kamala Harris, as you'll remember, she was in the debates. And at the debates, she was taken down by Tulsi Gabbard. Tulsi Gabbard brought up her prosecutorial record, and that was it. And Kamala had no response. And not even at the debate, she had no real response. And then afterwards, when Anderson Cooper, in a follow-up discussion following the debates, gave her another opportunity to rebut it, all she could bring up is, well, Tulsi Gabbard, she has ties to the Syrian government, Bashar Assad, as if that changes the reality of her record. Kamala Harris's record as prosecutor in California is very, very disturbing. And so the American people didn't vote for her. And but yet she's back on the ticket. Joe Biden, many people have questions about, you know, he will be the oldest president in all of U.S. history if he is elected. And will he be able to complete his 4 years? If he's not, Kamala Harris will be our next president, despite the fact that at the polls, the American people decided against her. And I also believe that it's pretty clear that Joe Biden worked pretty hard to not pick her as his VP. And I get into that in the book as well. There's a lot of hints that Joe Biden was thinking anyone but her. And I think you can put this into the context of the clash between the Obama White House and the Hillary Clinton State Department.
So this was during the Obama administration. Hillary Clinton represented the more hawkish interventionist wing. I know with the Washington Post, they praised the selection of Kamala Harris as her foreign policy. Like, they used the word muscular liberalism. So could she play that role in, as far as foreign policy goes, comparable in a Biden administration, comparable to the role Hillary Clinton played in the State Department?
Yes, I think absolutely. I think that the forces that very much wanted Hillary Clinton to be president and then ended up, you know, backing her as Secretary of State have put their forces and their energy behind Kamala Harris now. First for president, the voters didn't buy it, now as vice president. And that that there is a particular faction that is committed to unleashing chaos globally in order to bring down governments and secure the rule of Wall Street. And that Barack Obama tried to restrain this faction. And, you know, the New Yorker, there was a very good article that exposed how, you know, Hillary Clinton had you know, protected Jared Andrew Cohen when Jared Andrew Cohen, without the permission of the White House, was giving directions to Twitter about how to sow unrest inside of the Islamic Republic of Iran. And the Obama administration tried to fire Jared Andrew Cohen for it. Hillary Clinton protected him. Hillary Clinton is proud of it. Barack Obama says that his most proud moment as president was in 2013 when he was able to not send cruise missiles to Syria, right? When, you know, there was this allegation about a chemical attack and it looked like the USA was on the brink of, you know, bombing Syria with cruise missiles. Obama didn't do it. He says that was his most proud moment. Well, Hillary Clinton wanted him to do it. And Obama says that his greatest regret as president was the intervention in Libya, going in without a clear plan. Who was pushing Barack Obama to go in to Libya? Hillary Clinton was. And that there was a clear difference between the Obama White House, Joe Biden, John Kerry, who eventually became the next Secretary of State, replacing Hillary Clinton, and the Hillary Clinton State Department, that there were clear differences there. And that the Hillary Clinton State Department had people like Samantha Power, Anne Marie Slaughter, and others, right? Jared Andrew Cohen, who have a particular agenda. You know, Anne Marie Slaughter wrote an article for the Foreign Affairs magazine right after Trump was elected. The issue was called The Power of Populism. She believes there is a fight going on in the world today between what she calls the open international system and, quote-unquote, populist governments around the world. And the way she sees it, the job of the United States is to utilize social media to foment unrest and chaos in order to bring down these populist governments that get in the way of the great open international system.
So Gaddafi or an Assad, examples of that, or you could say like Milosevic under Clinton?
Sure, or Russia and China today, or Venezuela, or, you know, in 2009, the first coup that took place under the Barack Obama administration was when the government of Manuel Zelaya, an elected socialist, was toppled by the military. And Barack Obama in 2009, he was kind of startled by it. And they asked him about it after the government of Honduras was toppled in 2009. And he said, well, it's clearly not legal, because it's not legal for the military to topple a government. He didn't know what was going on. Little did he know that Hillary Clinton had been meeting with the coup plotters and had been having, and the coup plotters had been in Washington, and that Hillary Clinton had been working to carry that coup out and topple the government of Honduras basically behind his back, right? And that Honduras, a number of the refugees on the border that we hear so much about, are coming from Honduras. Ever since 2009, Honduras has been gripped by instability, drug cartels. It has, I think, the highest murder rate of any country in the world. And people are fleeing in big numbers. Life has become unlivable because of a regime of narco chaos and instability that was imposed on Honduras by the Hillary Clinton State Department. And that in and of itself, it's very similar to what's happened to Syria, right? We can be critical of the Syrian government, but what has been the results of the efforts to destabilize Syria instability, the rise of ISIL terrorism, right? What has been the results of the overthrow of Gaddafi in Libya? Instability, chaos, mass refugees. People are drowning in the Mediterranean trying to get out of the humanitarian crisis that was created in Libya. These regime change operations don't result in making people's lives better. They result in further instability and chaos and misery. And we see this over and over again. And Obama, you know, he criticized Bush for that. And he came into office to some degree. He wanted to sign the Iran nuclear deal. He wanted to repair relations with Cuba. And he was able to do that to some degree or other, but it seems that the Hillary Clinton State Department was working against him at every moment. And that becomes very, very clear, and that Kamala Harris is seen not as a successor to Barack Obama, but as a successor to the Hillary Clinton State Department. The same backing, the same crew of international interests that backed Hillary Clinton have now backed Kamala Harris. That's very, very well documented. She is their new pick. I believe that she will come into office with a similar agenda.
Do you see dangers under Kamala Harris or at a Biden-Harris administration of abuses of civil liberties, including like tech totalitarianism, like a tech crackdown on dissidents, probably both from the left and the right?
I absolutely do. I think that what's going to happen, I mean, it's been
or basically like clear. I'd say like preventing another Trump or Bernie.
Right, nailing the door shut, and that's been made pretty clear that that the factions that are backing Joe Biden, they view Donald Trump as the result of too much freedom on the internet, too many competing ideas, you know, the idea that there is alternative media coming from other countries like Russia or China or Iran or Venezuela, and they want to get into office and nail the door shut to make sure that no other Trump is possible. Now, that might sound good if you don't like Trump, but remember, you couldn't have had Trump without Bernie Sanders, right? The Bernie Sanders and the hopes of so many people that backed him and the way he was robbed of the Democratic nomination and the way, you know, many, many people in the Rust Belt states who had wanted to put their hope behind a left-wing populist, a lot of them ended up voting for a right-wing populist. That Trump and Bernie are both symptoms of a growing distrust of the status quo. And the argument of the Biden campaign is not that we should, you know, be critical of the status quo from the left, but it's rather that criticism of the status quo is a Russian conspiracy, and that every effort needs to be made to crack down on people not trusting our great democratic institutions. If you're a person who has marched against wars or marched against police brutality or marched against injustice in this country, you should be very disturbed by some of the statements that we're hearing about the plans of a Biden administration. I mean, they plan to get in there and make sure that competing narratives and contrary information is not allowed. I mean, they're very open about intending to do that.
And would this be through legislation or executive orders or more through collaboration with tech companies?
I think it would be more collaboration with tech. Trump has a hostile relationship with big tech for whatever reason. He sees big tech as out to get him. There's this right-wing YouTube channel, PragerU, that got to go to Capitol Hill and talk about how YouTube is rigged against them, and that Trump very much feels that Twitter and Facebook and Google are working against him, and he's trying to, you know, roll back their ability to set the terms. Whereas Biden promised in his article in Foreign Affairs, which he wrote, America Must Lead Again, he promised that he would convene an international summit about controlling information around the world and combating the ideas of foreign countries and coming in and trying to basically control discourse in the United States and working with big tech, working internationally to try and control discourse. And that should be very disturbing to any progressive-minded person. I would absolutely think it would be disturbing. I mean, again, right, you know, within the Trump camp, let me point this out. The Trump camp, you know, they're often accused of being totalitarian and fascist and such, and there's plenty of, you know, good points people make when they point that out. But I can think of about 16 different types of Trump supporters. You've got religious fanatics, you've got QAnon, you've got gun supporters, you know, you've got, you know, people that are, you know, Miami Cubans or people that are, you know, big supporters of Netanyahu. There's a wide coalition of people in the Trump camp. In the Democratic camp, I increasingly hear more and more kind of totalitarianism. For example, Tulsi Gabbard recently criticized Netflix. She said, you know what, I don't approve of this new film Netflix is making. I think it's, you know, it's not appropriate to have young girls dancing this way or whatever. That's all she said. Immediately, the Democratic establishment came down on her all over social media. simply for criticizing Netflix. You know, she was put in the category of QAnon. She was accused of being a Trump supporter. That's far more totalitarian. I see much more ideological diversity among Trump supporters. It happens to be a lot of views I don't agree with. But among the Democratic camp, there is this increasing, you know, being a Democrat means you support the status quo. You don't believe in, quote unquote, conspiracy theories. You don't believe in you know, any standard criticism of the official U.S. narrative. You believe that somehow the 2016 elections were the result of a vast foreign plot. You almost have to think of Donald Trump like he's the Manchurian candidate. And if you don't accept this overall narrative that comes from Rachel Maddow, that comes from the mainstream voices, if you don't accept that, even if you're on the left, you're a racist, you're a fascist, you're a crypto-fascist, you're a red-brown, and you're not welcome. I mean, the attack on Bernie Sanders supporters and Bernie bros for daring to criticize things. I mean, I see a lot more thought conformity in the Democratic camp than I do in the Republican camp right now.
Oh, yeah, that's definitely the case. Like what they were saying, like accusing Tulsi of being a Russian asset. Just looking at the election, I remember in 2016, Trump did make more populist arguments in opposition to Hillary Clinton about war and about things like NAFTA and the economic plutocracy. And obviously you're not you don't like Trump, but hypothetically, if you were to advise Trump, would have so many opportunities to criticize Biden from a populist standpoint, including NAFTA, but all he's saying is basically that Biden is a Trojan horse for socialism in the far left.
Right. Yeah. And the thing is, I mean, Trump, you know, he said some stuff about he was going to build infrastructure. Well, that hasn't happened. He said he was going to stop meddling around the world and overthrowing regimes. Well, there's been how many attempts to violently overthrow the Venezuelan government now? He escalated tensions with Iran. He's ripped up the INF treaty and is basically trying his hardest to restart the nuclear arms race with Russia. You know, Donald Trump has not fulfilled a lot of the better things he said during his campaign, no question about it. Donald Trump seems to have made an alliance with a particular faction. Gina Haspel and Mike Pompeo, they come out of a faction within the CIA. The thing is, the CIA tends to be a more liberal agency, right? I mean, the military, they're about blowing things up and big weapons, but the CIA, that's people out of Harvard and Yale who carefully study about how to strategically push the interests of the United States with soft power and maneuver and you know, cultivate proxies around the world and maintain alliances. You know, it's much more of a liberal way of looking at things, where you want to be friendly to people and get along and operate, you know, covertly. However, there is a particular faction, Gina Haspel and Mike Pompeo and the Bush family, I think, that have a different view than the rest of the agency. And that is who Trump has kind of made an alliance with. The issue of torture is a great example. John Brennan, who was Obama's CIA director, said he would never torture anyone, that if Obama asked him to torture, he would step down. And that if, you know, the CIA's job is to maintain good relationships, have the United States loved around the world. So, of course, having the United States have a no-torture policy makes sense. However, Gina Haspel and Mike Pompeo are in a minority faction within the CIA. That's where they come out of. That didn't view it that way. That argued that perhaps it would be in the interest of the United States to be known to have a reputation for torturing people around the world, to scare people into submission, right? That is not the view that most people within the CIA have. And you can go back to what happened with Valerie Plame and Dick Cheney and that whole debacle. And that it's clear that there are contradictions within the deep state. Again, now when I say deep state, I'm not talking about some vast conspiracy of pedophiles drinking blood and Satan. I'm talking about the vast, you know, intelligence apparatus in the United States, you know. Most countries, they have one security service, right? They have their security service. Here in the United States, we have the FBI, we have the CIA, we have the NSA, we have U.S. Army intelligence, we have U.S. Navy intelligence. You know, we have a number of intelligence agencies. Plus, they all tend to contract private firms for their work, right? So they're all contracting different security companies, different cybersecurity companies. So there's a huge problem now in the United States with what I think you could call deep state overlap, where there are many, many different agencies with many, many different agendas competing with each other with different views and all, you know, trying to compete for the same budget and get more support from the government. And this is leading to a bit of a disaster. And that you know, where did the FBI stand? You know, when Trump fired James Comey, many in the FBI viewed that as an attack on the sovereignty of the FBI as an institution and the Department of Justice, and that there are clear disagreements within the American power structure.
One thing you do talk about is like the divisions in the elites and the power structure. Basically, like one side is more manufacturing or like the fracking industry, and then the other side would be big tech or Wall Street. You actually give examples. There's the divide of the sort of industrialist versus the northeastern establishment. That's been a long-going divide throughout the 20th century, and you see that with Trump versus Bezos and the divide in our ruling class. So, to what degree does Kamala Harris represent this split in the ruling class?
I think that the faction, you know, the division, I've often said there's a division between the rich and the ultra-rich. And I'm not the first person to say that. You know, Ferdinand Lundberg wrote a lot about that, about the role of the Rockefeller family and how, you know, during the early Cold War, it seemed like the Rockefeller family was almost at odds with the rest of American capitalism. And that, you know, the big four supermajor oil companies and Silicon Valley, they represent one particular faction that is probably the richest of the rich, probably the most powerful faction within the ruling class of the United States. And they are at odds with a lot of the manufacturers, a lot of the, you know, the Pentagon contractors, for example, the fracking companies that are competing with big oil, and they have different interests. And I think that what you can call the Eastern establishment, which tends to be big oil and Wall Street and now Silicon Valley, they are more globally concerned. They're about that open international system that Anne-Marie Slaughter wrote about. And Kamala Harris is very much working for them. She is with them. And they are very much in a struggle against kind of an uprising within their own class, against the lower levels. Betsy DeVos is a great example, right? She's a billionaire. She's Trump's Secretary of Education. But Betsy DeVos, you know, she's not part of the club. Her money comes from Amway Tupperware parties, right? I mean, she's, you know, that it's allegedly a multi-level marketing scheme, this is where her wealth comes from. She's also tied to Blackwater, the weapons the military contracting company, the private, you know, security firm, Academy is what they're now known as, I believe. She's tied to that. Eric Prince is her brother, and they have a very different interest. You can talk about the Koch brothers. You can talk about Bernie Marcus, the owner of Home Depot, if you go to a Home Depot, almost every item you're going to find on the shelf is going to be a company that's somehow contracted by the Pentagon. And that there are competing interests here, and that the Eastern establishment that is more globally concerned, more thinking in terms of maintaining the dominance of Western oil companies and Western tech giants on the global scale, competing basically with the rest of American capital that is more domestically concerned and more concerned about their short-term profits. I've often said that there's a division between a managerial bourgeoisie that is trying to have social peace and stability.
So
in the
I'm
long
not sure
term.
If you've seen the article by The Bellows, but it's called the Horseshoe Class Theory, and it shows the different like small scale businesses and industrialists, and then different layers of the managerial class, and it basically says how different class angles of the horseshoe align that basically dictates like what political agenda we'll have.
I haven't seen the article. I'll have to check it out.
So what would you say is the long-term geopolitical strategy, especially for the faction of the elite that you would describe as the Northeastern establishment? But I guess if you want to comment, do both of those groups have any long-term geopolitical strategy? And how will the election outcome impact that?
Well, I think that for Trump's faction, the way he sees things is he wants to keep a kind of diverse group of constituents happy. He wants to make lots of money for weapons manufacturers. He wants to have American energy dominance and, you know, get the price of oil up and have frackers sell lots of oil. And that's where he's at. And he wants to help Netanyahu in Israel and help Netanyahu stay on top of Israeli politics. And, you know, and that's what he's about. Whereas, you know, it's more about short-term profits in the Trump camp. That's really what it's about. Profits for oil companies, profits for weapons manufacturers, political gain for certain factions he's aligned with internationally. That's about it. It's a short-term strategy. Whereas I think that the Eastern establishment, the Council on Foreign Relations, they're thinking more long-term. They're seeing the rise of Russia and China around the world. They're seeing kind of an alternative economy growing on the global stage. And they want to think strategically about how we stabilize the United States and not have so much dissent and unhappiness over here, number one. And then on top of that, how we can, in the long term, roll back the influence of the various countries around the world that have broken out of the domination of Western corporations. They may want to do it with soft power. They may want to do it by staging revolts and uprisings. And we've seen the results of what this particular faction has done in Honduras, in Libya, in Syria, and elsewhere. And we're still dealing with the humanitarian fallout of their strategy of fomenting chaos, right? I think that you go back to the Cold War. During Roosevelt's time, there was a difference. How do we fight the communists? How do we fight the communists during the Great Depression? One faction said, we lock down as a country. We have the military take over, and we outlaw labor unions and communists, and we become a very authoritarian society. Well, Roosevelt did not agree with that. The National Association of Manufacturers and Henry Morgan felt that way. Roosevelt wanted to preserve civil liberties and have more stability. He and the Rockefellers entered an alliance with organized labor and with the Communist Party to beat back that kind of militarist fascist opposition. And they argued that the way to defeat forces of opposition around the world was by having more openness and creating more chaos, essentially, right?
That dividing the elite, how much is there an economic angle? It seems like the lower levels of the elite, like the mid-sized manufacturing, there would just seem like there's more of a libertarian ideology. But with the Northeastern establishment, what is their general economic outlook?
Well, they tend to have a more libertarian outlook, I think, simply because they're not going to get the government contract. They know that there are richer folks out there, and that if the state is involved, the government will pick winners and losers, and because they're lower on the totem pole, they're less likely to get the government contract, and they don't like that, and they resent the power of big monopolies. They see the state is protecting big monopolies. They want more of a free market so that they can have a chance, They also tend to really believe in the free market ideology that we get in the United States. I mean, the richest of the rich kind of realize that capitalism left to its own devices is very unstable and has a lot of problems. But, people who are the first generation in their family to be wealthy, they tend to really believe that if you just work hard in America, you can become rich. And if other people weren't lazy, they'd be rich like them. You know, the Ayn Rand stuff, the more libertarian stuff tends to be more popular. I mean, the fracking companies are known for having that kind of viewpoint. And this was the viewpoint of the John Birch Society, which accused the Rockefellers of being communists back in the 1950s. They have a more libertarian outlook, and they tend to really believe that that free competition is best, and they resent the state favoring big monopolies. Whereas the big monopolies, they fear a situation where they would lose that big monopoly, which would be some kind of big social overturn, some kind of big turnaround, which would result from a populist leader or some kind of mass uprising in society. So they're more concerned about preserving social peace so they can keep their position at the top, rather than about their short-term profits and deregulation.
To what degree do you see Trump, if he's reelected, being any kind of impediment to the agenda of the Northeastern establishment and like liberal internationalism?
Well, I think that Donald Trump, he does not care how the rest of the world sees the United States. He's not afraid to insult Muslims. He's not afraid to insult different countries. He is not afraid to escalate tension when it pleases him. And because of that, he will make it difficult for the United States to maintain the kind of alliances that it's built up. The way the United States was able to destabilize Syria was because of a longstanding alliance with the Muslim Brotherhood and with various Wahhabi fanatical groups that have ties to Saudi Arabia. Barack Obama, during the Arab Spring, there was a feeling among the Muslim community of the world, especially in the Arab countries, that for once there was a leader who kind of understood them. He went to a Muslim school when he was growing up in Indonesia, and that during the Arab Spring there was trust for the United States by the Muslim Brotherhood and by some Wahhabi fanatics, and so they were kind of unleashed in Syria to destabilize Syria on behalf of the United States. If Trump had been the president during the Arab Spring, I really doubt that would have happened. Trump is widely hated by Muslims around the world. He's seen as an anti-Islamic bigot. He's seen as a greedy capitalist who's kind of the symbol of everything that's wrong with those who, viewed as wrong by those who criticize U.S. society. It's a very different kind of image, and that that cultivating the illusions and keeping people around the world trusting of the United States, having the United States be very, very polite in the way it deals with different nations and such, that's essential to what the Eastern establishment does, right? It's a long-term strategy of carefully unleashing chaos. It's very similar to what Zbigniew Brzezinski did during the Cold War. He realized that having big wars in Vietnam and Korea and killing millions of people wasn't exactly good PR for the United States, and in the long term kind of helped the communists. So what was much more effective was to pick out some communists that you like, give them covert U.S. support, arm them to fight other communists, make it all very, very confusing. And we saw that with the Kampuchea War. We saw that with the rise of Euro-communism in Europe and the Western European communist parties cutting their ties to the Soviet Union. We saw that as Poland began to have tension with the USSR, Romania began to have tension with the USSR, China and the Soviet Union were at each other's throats. The way the Cold War was won for the United States was not by attacking communism with brute force. It was by manipulating communists against each other in order to create chaos. And that was the strategy of Zbigniew Brzezinski. And it was very, very successful. And it requires, you know, kind of courting different people around the world and utilizing them as proxy.
And with these divides in geopolitics, so there was that tension between Qatar and Saudi Arabia. Do some of those divides, like in the Middle East, reflect the divides between Trump and then versus the Northeastern establishment?
Yeah, Trump has thrown down with Saudi Arabia. He talked against them on the campaign trail a lot. He bashed them. But once he's been in office, I mean, he went to Saudi Arabia. He danced with the Saudi king. He loves Saudi Arabia. Even after they killed Jamal Khashoggi and everything there, he says, look, you know, that we weapon sales, it's important. He is down for Saudi Arabia. Meanwhile, you know, Qatar, right, and Turkey are both the major funders of the Muslim Brotherhood, which is a very different current, right? Saudi Arabia's Wahhabism and the Muslim Brotherhood, they're completely different, views of Islam. And, you know, Saudi Arabia has accused Qatar of funding terrorism. Trump echoed that allegation. U.S.-Turkish relations are certainly not very good right now. And that I think, you know, under Barack Obama, there was very much, you know, a situation where Saudi Arabia and their wing of Islam around the world and Turkey and Qatar and their wing of Islam around the world were kind of lined up. Now it seems very clear that if you watch Al Jazeera, if you pay attention to what's coming out of Turkey and the countries aligned with the Muslim Brotherhood, they are very, very opposed to Donald Trump. Meanwhile, Donald Trump is very, very much in favor of Saudi Arabia. And that these two poles that were once both aligned with the United States and the Muslim world are now at odds with each other. And the Muslim Brotherhood seems to be, you know, distancing itself from the United States. Now, I have a feeling that if Biden, you know, is elected, that a Biden-Harris administration would probably try to restore that relationship.
Do you think there would likely be a greater intervention under Biden-Harris than Trump?
I think so, absolutely, yes. But again, it would probably start as quote-unquote civil wars in countries, covert operations, instability, and then the United States would come in, like in Libya or like in Syria, to, you know, quote-unquote rescue rebels in the country, right? It would start out that way, and that's how these wars tend to start. What Bush did with his direct invasion of Iraq was quite unpopular in Europe, and the Eastern establishment wing is very much interested in maintaining the NATO alliance, which Trump, let's remember, has gone out of his way to offend a lot of NATO allies. So, you know, Rand Paul praised Donald Trump for being the first president to not start a new war. Well, Donald Trump has done quite a few things to escalate international tension, but it is true. There's not a new front, a new country, that has entered a global conflict under Trump that I can think of. And that may be just because his agenda of selling lots of weapons around the world, it doesn't really line up with having a new front of confrontation. Plus, I think there are a lot of people in the Pentagon who realize that that Al-Qaeda types and ISIS types and the kinds of terrorists that do kill Americans, that those forces have gotten stronger, and that, you know, overthrowing, you know, or trying to overthrow Bashar Assad, someone who was so opposed to Al-Qaeda, he even offered to torture, you know, people for the Bush administration. Gaddafi, also, you know, so opposed to Al-Qaeda that he offered to torture people, that overthrowing Saddam Hussein, for example, who was a secular Ba'athist Arab leader, and that has created a political space in which the kind of terrorist groups that actually do kill Americans, right, like, you know, ISIS, Al-Qaeda type groups, have gotten stronger. We're supposed to be fighting a war on terror, but instead of fighting the terrorists, we're fighting the enemies of the terrorists. We're fighting the nationalist, independent, and socialist governments that tend to hold back the terrorists. Meanwhile, the ideology that these terrorist groups believe in, Wahhabism, comes out of Saudi Arabia, and there's no questioning of the U.S. relationship with Saudi Arabia, and that ideology is everywhere, and the United States seems to be happy to use Wahhabi fanatics as kind of covert foot soldiers in these regime change wars, and then act surprised when they turn around and attack the United States. And that is an ongoing problem that we have had. I think that the Muslim ban that Trump did, I mean, many people call it that, the travel ban, the visa ban, what that was about was the fact that in many countries, various forces that are aligned with the United States in efforts to bring down for countries like the Syrian government and all of that are rewarded with visas, right? If you fight for the United States, if you're an ally of the United States, you or your family get rewarded with a visa. And I think that people within the Trump administration think that's not such a good idea. And they took this soft power negotiating bargaining chip away from the CIA. And in Syria, in Yemen, in various countries around the world, the CIA can no longer, you know, bribe people by offering them a U.S. visa any longer. And I think that's what it was about. It was taking a bargaining chip away from the CIA.
I want to get back to Kamala Harris. To what degree, taking into account her background growing up in Berkeley, is she a product of the New Left? And also, how connected is the New Left to plutocratic economic interest and then the sort of general discussion of, like, the Northeastern establishment?
Sure. I mean, as far as that, I mean, Kamala Harris, she grew up, her parents met at protests for civil rights in Berkeley, California. She was born in 1964 in Berkeley, the same year that the free speech movement happened. In her memoir, she describes going to Rainbow Sign, which was an African-American cultural center that was, you know, very much, you know, frequented by figures like James Baldwin and others. And she comes out of the New Left. And that's very surprising when you look at her behavior as a prosecutor. You would think that she grew up, you know, in that thin blue line milieu that thinks that criminals are out of control and that the police have their hands tied. You know, her behavior might make sense if that's how she saw the world. But she grew up attending protests against racism and becoming very much, you know, oriented toward, you know, black nationalism and, you know, civil rights demonstrations and progressivism and leftism. And I argue in the book that there was a huge effort, you know, that started with the CIA's Congress for Cultural Freedom program to distort and manipulate leftist politics. The CIA very much felt that they did not want people in the United States who protested for civil rights or protested, against the mistreatment of women or against capitalism and war. They didn't want them to become natural allies of the Soviet Union, and that a huge effort was made to build up what you can call the anti-Stalinist left. That was done, right? And figures like Susan Sontag, figures like Hannah Arendt, Partisan Review magazine, all these things are revealed. It's now a matter of public record that these things were covertly funded by the CIA in the hopes of creating a new kind of left, a left
that
was not...
So is this where you get, right-wing populist... They'll actually outright say that all leftism is a product of, like, bankers, but is this where they get their theories from?
I don't know. I mean, I think that in a lot of cases, that's just anti-Semitism, right? I mean, from the right, it's just, you know, I mean, when they say that leftism is all the product of bankers, that's anti-Semitism because, I mean, that's I think they're just using banker as code for Jew, and that's just, you know, Jews are communist, Jews are bankers, anti-Semitism. That's all that is coming from most of the right. There may be some on the right who are able to understand this with a little more depth. You know, and I think that there are a lot of, like, these middle class elements that you know, feel like big capital and big corporations are coming down pretty hard on them. And they also fear the left and labor unions. And so in their minds, they kind of push them together. And I think that's what that's about. I think there's a lot of social conservatives also who are very aware of the fact that, you know, not every advance of social liberalism is purely the result of an uprising from below. That, you know, the Rockefeller family did fund the work of Alfred Kinsey, for example. They did bankroll the Birth Control League, which eventually became Planned Parenthood. And that they're, you know, this Eastern establishment that is more liberal is more socially liberal. And that, you know, the motivation that the Rockefellers had for supporting the woman's right to an abortion and legalization of birth control, it wasn't so much about concern for women's rights as belief in Malthusianism. And belief that there are too many people in the world and fearing the instability of quote-unquote overpopulation, especially as capitalism advances with technology and there's a smaller place for people at the assembly line. And so because of that, you do see some elements of big capital funding social liberalism, not economic socialism or leftism, but social liberalism. And I think that some on the right are aware of that. And of course, they fit this into a kind of a conspiracy theory mentality, and they're defending, you know, the old way, and they want to go back to the 1920s or something. That's not my viewpoint at all. But it is important to point out that social liberalism, in some cases, does make things more profitable for capitalists, right? That not every lifting of social restraints has been done purely because it will, you know, give a greater level of freedom to the proletariat. That there are contradictions among the ruling class.
Why do you think that anti-populism, including anti-worker too, became a theme within the New Left?
I think it's mainly because after the Second World War, the U.S. middle class greatly expanded, right? We started to have a lot more middle class people in the United States. And both the left and the right changed after the Second World War. On the right, we got neoconservatism. On the left, we got the New Left. And the New Left was very much, it wasn't about workers rising up against capitalists and the working class majority seizing control of the means of production. It was rather about alienated intellectuals being protected from the mob, you know, and it viewed, you know, the broad masses of people as potentially dangerous, as potentially coming to take the freedoms away from those intellectuals. And it saw leftism about preserving the freedom of the intellectuals. And that's what comes across if you read Hannah Arendt and Susan Sontag, and the fact that they conflate, you know, the Soviet Union and Marxism with fascism very openly. They call them red fascists. Susan Sontag said something like, you know, communism is just fascism with a human face. In their minds, they're both dangerous because they're both populism. They're both ordinary people rising up and taking history into their own hands.
Sort of the same way that Trump, by establishment neoliberals, they actually view Trump and Bernie the same way. I mean, I actually saw, like, you posted a video of a woman at a resist rally putting a Soviet hammer and sickle over Trump.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, I here in New York City, I remember I went to a rally. I was interviewing some anti-Trump protesters, and they, you know, Trump with a hammer and sickle on him is very common. And I've said to people, do you think Trump is a communist? And they said, no, he's a fascist. And I said, well, I mean, those are not the same thing. You know, those two groups killed each other in the streets. There was the Second World War. You know, there's a whole history of communists marching for civil rights and defending the rights of African Americans while fascists built lynch mobs. You know, these are two different viewpoints. But if your viewpoint is simply that it's about the freedom of the individual against a dangerous mob, a dangerous collective, if that's the way you view the world, as the individual against collectivism, in your mind you're going to equate the two. However, if you understand that one is trying to lead to a stateless, classless world and create so much material abundance that there can be a higher level of freedom than ever before and advance human progress, and another is trying to reinforce social hierarchies with all kinds of brute force and repression, you're going to see things very, very differently. But that is the difference in viewpoint. You know, the middle class viewpoint that fears the mob is going to equate the two because it opposes collectivism by its very nature, not necessarily taking into account what that collectivism stands for and strives for.
Is there anything else you'd like to add on the topic of Kamala Harris? And basically, like, what if she is successful and she does become president, what her long-term legacy will be?
Well, I fear that her long-term legacy will be lots of wars around the world, and I also fear that at home there will be a higher level of censorship and repression of those of us who have dissident views. Already, we're starting to see kind of a stigma develop against, you know, the slightest criticism of the status quo is being considered to be a dangerous conspiracy theory. Tulsi Gabbard, you know, just recently being attacked simply for criticizing Netflix for making this film that many people are quite disturbed by. That kind of ideological conformity, I fear that there is going to be a bigger and bigger effort by Silicon Valley and by Google and other forces to control political discourse at home, and that will then facilitate the escalation of more wars and conflicts and instability around the world in the hopes of preserving the power and preserving this open international system that Anne-Marie Slaughter speaks about. And I don't think that's desirable. Then again, Trump's anti-immigrant bigotry and Trump's support for police brutality and his hatred, and that's not something I support either. So I'm not here to tell you who to vote for. I'm just here to tell you that on the liberal side, there's a lot of dangers that I think some people are overlooking.
Caleb, before I wrap up the show, do you want to plug your website, any other books you have besides the Kamala Harris books, or just any upcoming projects?
Sure. Well, I wrote a book called City Builders and Vandals in Our Age, which is articles and essays on socialism. And it goes over human history, and it talks about the 20th century and the Cold War, and it reexamines Marxism in a new light. And many, many people have said that book was very, very eye-opening for them. It changed how they understood the topic of socialism and Marxism. And many people have pointed out that the way I talk about these issues is quite different than the way most people on the left do, and that I bring kind of a unique perspective. You can check out my work at CalebMaupin.com, CalebMaupin.com.
Caleb Maupin, it's been an excellent show. Thank you so much for being on.
Sure thing.